listening to Praxis on the Praxis podcast. The following is an interview I recorded this weekend with Travis and Carson from Deep Green Resistance Lower Columbia about their upcoming presentation, Business as Usual, The False Promises of Green Tech. That's going to be in Spokane, October 4th, this coming Saturday at 3 p.m. at the Downtown Library. I asked Travis and Carson how they got started with environmental activism and why they're coming to talk about this topic.
Okay, so this is Carson. I've kind of been interested in environmentalism since, like, I was a kid. I remember in school taking kind of a class and, like, an extracurricular activity where we, it was about environmental science, and I remember building, like, a little miniature solar-powered car with, like, balsa wood and straws and, like, a mini solar panel, and, you know, we toured a wind farm out in Eastern Oregon. Although the one memory of that I do have is that, they'd opened up all these new turbines and it was just dead calm. It was not a breath of wind that day. And I guess now, you know, as an adult with more information and more kind of critical thinking skills, I should have taken that as an omen, for reasons we'll go into later. But, so like a lot of people, I kind of became a little bit disenchanted with environmentalism after seeing how much work goes into these campaigns and how rare a resounding kind of success is. I mean, sometimes environmentalism, it feels like we're kind of being routed in terms of the markers that really matter, like the health of the planet and health of our land bases. I became kind of disenchanted, and I didn't really participate in a lot of activism until I read a book by Derek Jensen called What We Leave Behind, which presented to me some ideas that I had never encountered before, especially not in sort of mainstream liberal environmental organizing. Talking about ecocentrism and the natural world being primary, and how, you know, all this sort of mainstream activism is really centered around trying to protect industrial capitalism and not protecting the natural world. So that led me down a whole kind of anti-civ or anti-civilization rabbit hole, and all the kind of the literature that goes along that. And in 2012, I joined the social justice and environmental group, Deep Green Resistance. I'm currently a member of the administrative board of that organization. And I gave a talk. I was on a panel with another comrade of mine at the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference back in February of this year. And right now, since then, I've pretty much been putting all my kind of activist energy into the speaking tour that's going on.
Great. And how about you, Travis?
Great. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you, Taylor, for inviting us on your show. Appreciate that. And like Carson, I've had a kind of a gradual progression to this point in my life and activism. I was fortunate enough to live and grow up on and actually be living on the same piece of land for the last almost 30 years. And it's a beautiful place along the Washougal River in Southwest Washington. And I think just growing up on the land and, you know, being part of the natural region there had had a big impact on myself. I think the other thing that would be a marker in my activism in life was I spent 4 years living in Chile. And I worked with Greenpeace and an agency run by the government, another environmental organization down there. And so just like my time there, and then when I returned to the States and came across also a book by Derek Jensen, I think a former native or a former resident of Spokane,
mm-hmm.
I read his book, in game. And that was really a turning point for me, and made me realize that in order to be effective in what we're doing, we need to really change course and look for a new strategy.
Yeah. So this event coming up on Saturday, for listeners, I guess it'll be this coming Saturday, October 4th at 3 p.m. at the Spokane Public Library downtown. It's called Business as Usual, The False Solutions of Green Tech. So you're both talking about both coincidentally reading Jensen, which was also kind of a shift for me too, reading some of his work when I was younger. So in what ways is, when you say green tech, there's a picture of a windmill on the Facebook event here. You've talked about wind. I know you're also referencing solar. What does that phrase business as usual mean to you? And in what ways are these false solutions? What are you going to talk about on Saturday?
Yeah, so in the course of our environmental and social justice activism with the green resistance, we really, green technology has come up as a barrier. I think it takes a really complex problem that interconnects really everything in our lives, from our relationships to each other with the natural world, to our language, our religion, our stories, and it reduces all of that to just an issue of technology only. And it really stunts and heads off the kind of transformation that I think makes for great organizing and great kind of critical thinking. So an example of this I went to the People Climate March here in Hood River, and there were a lot of speeches, but almost none of them had to do with salmon or migratory songbirds or any of the things that really interest me and matter to me that I think really have the most value. But there were a lot of speeches about wind turbines and our clean and green economy that we're trying to build. And that's just one in a litany of things that I've experienced that really fundamentally make me believe that the modern environmental movement has been co-opted by the very system that it was originally trying to challenge. And
the economic system, right?
Sorry?
The economic system, like capitalism, is what you're talking about there?
Exactly. Capitalism, industrialism, the sort of settled, civilized kind of life way that we are currently living under, that is based on drawdown. It's based on denuding the land base and taking more resources than the land can offer. And so that's the path that we've been on for the last 10,000 years, and we're seeing the perfect consequences of that. So,
no, and I just add to that, based on violence. Well, violence in every form, every way. Here in the industrialized first world, where we don't see a lot of those things. But many of us are privileged and aren't affected directly, but the rest of the world is being affected by these things day in and day out.
Yeah, that's a question I found mildly effective to ask people when they talk about solarizing the U.S. as a solution to global warming. You know, you ask them, well, who's going to be in the mines? Who's going to go dig up all those rare earth minerals and all the other things needed to build the solar panels? And that can usually start a conversation. It's not the most positive way to start a conversation, but that's part of what you're referring to, I think.
Yeah, and I think, just to take an example, a wind turbine. So a wind turbine is made of 60%, and I'm just going off of one of the most common turbines on the market. It's a 1.5 megawatt model made by GE. It's actually on the small end. There are turbines that are many, many times larger than this, but just for the sake of our argument, we go with probably the most prolific turbine currently on the market and used around the world. So the main base component that comprises the majority of the materials in the turbine is steel. Now, steel isn't exactly the poster child of environmental organizing. It's not really the war cry that environmentalists kind of invoke when we talk about dirty extractive industries. I guess it just doesn't have the glamour of fracking or coal, but it's really destructive. I mean, the largest iron ore mine, which is iron ore is the main raw material in steel, is located in the heart of the Amazon rainforest, and just all of the, it's called the Carajas mine. It produces 90 million tons, I think, of steel per year, and it's responsible for poisoning the rivers with mercury, oppressing indigenous people. Just the activities around the mine, such as deforestation, I think 6,000 square kilometers of forest, they cut down in the vicinity of the mine. That's not even related to deforestation that takes place due to, you know, direct mining activity. So a lot of that rainforest gets turned into charcoal. And it's just a nightmare for the planet. But it's, steel is one of the fundamental markers of, I'm using air quotes here, a developed economy. I think the World Bank estimates that to be at a certain level of economic development, standard of what's considered a developed economy, there has to be a minimum of 700 pounds of steel consumption per person per year. So that's how integral steel is in the industrial economy. But what is not often talked about is that steel alone, just steel, accounts for 5% of global carbon emissions. And then you combine steel with concrete, which are, you know, the building blocks of the industrial infrastructure, that's 10% of carbon emissions. So all things being equal, if we had an absolute zero emission economy just by making steel and concrete, we would still have 10% of the carbon emissions currently going into the air that we do now. And obviously, that would be a huge reduction, but it's still anthropogenic carbon being emitted in the atmosphere, and the end result would be the same. And that's just a hypothetical. Obviously, you can't produce steel without lots of other fossil fuels being used as well. And you can't make steel without fossil fuels. Steel is a product of the fossil fuel age. It is iron ore is melted, and it's called a blast furnace. A blast furnace is fueled by metallurgical or coked coal, called coke as a shorthand. And coke has to be, it's basically coal that's been heated in an airtight chamber to about, 3,000 or 6,000 degrees. So yeah, you can't make steel without fossil fuels. You hear mainstream environmentalists talking about our clean, green wind and solar powered, economy, but, you know, how are you gonna build solar panels? How are you going to build wind turbines without steel? Steel is 60% of what's in a turbine. Then the other materials aren't so great either. I mean, you just talked about the rare earth minerals like cadmium, cobalt, silver. Those involve literally scraping topsoil off the face of the earth and then bathing it in frozen chemicals to extract the rare earths. I mean,
yeah.
There's also 700 pounds of copper in this GE turbine that I've been talking about. One of the largest copper mines in the world is in, it's near Salt Lake City, Utah, actually, and it contributes to Salt Lake City having the worst air quality of any city in the United States, worse than New York, worse than LA. So these are all questions that I think mainstream environmentalists have to answer for. You know, what level of destruction, what level of oppression and extraction is acceptable to you to make, not you, Taylor, but to the hypothetical mainstream environmentalist I'm talking to, you know, what's the acceptable level of disruption? And I say that there's no acceptable level of disruption, that, you know, if your way of life is based on violence, that says something about your culture, that says something about you.
And so have you found, it's really interesting, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance around this, because if you go to a group of, you know, environmentalists and say, this sounds like it's a setup for a joke, but it's not. A room full of environmentalists, and you say they want to put a copper mine in Alaska, and it's the salmon spawning ground. All of those people will say, well, no, we don't want another copper mine at all. We don't want to mine any more of this. And yet the solution that's being offered is this wonderful, shiny, job-creating, green economy utopia that's solar-powered and wind-powered. Have you personally, either of you, broached those conversations with people, and how have those confrontations gone? Because it is going to end up being confrontational. You're kind of you're getting underneath what people have held up as their hopeful solution. So how have those interactions gone, and do you have any strategies that maybe lessen the blow for people when you bring this up?
Yeah, that's always an interesting conversation to have. I recently gave a talk last week, actually, on this same topic. And the initial reaction for most is one of denial, one of rejection. And most people, you know, hearing it for the first time, because for most of us, or for many of us, this was not in realization that these green, so-called green technologies and renewable energy is not anything of the sort, is difficult to take on. And then last week, as I got through my presentation, I think more and more people were willing to engage in a real conversation that, allowed us to look at alternatives and different ways of, you know, possibly engaging in different activities. So that's been my experience.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, as far as lessening the blow, you can't take, I don't think you can take something away from someone without, you know, even kind of throwing them a bone, just to keep the conversation going. So oftentimes I'll talk about how people, well, I mean, not even in the past, in the present day, half the world's population lives without electricity. And before, I mean, my grandfather grew up without electricity. That's just one generation removed. And, you know, in between my grandfather and I, and yet, you know, now we can't even imagine. I mean, look at what we're sacrificing to produce all this electricity. So, I mean, that's a commentary on how fast we forget, but people lived full, beautiful, meaningful lives without the industrial economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if we're going to survive on this planet, if life is going to continue to survive on this planet, we need to relearn how to build those kind of societies.
Mm-hmm.
So human scale cultures that are very deeply embedded in the land base and have the health of the land provides for them as their primary value. But before I can get to talking about all of that, I think, well, there's kind of one of two initial reactions people have, and the first one is just putting up a wall. So I think green energy and environmentalism have become so synonymous that if you criticize green technology, people's first reaction is that you must be pro-fossil fuels. You must be an anti-environmentalist. And it takes them a while, for it to dawn on them that, obviously we're not pro-fossil fuel. I think that's a false dichotomy. And it's not a question of do we have a fossil fuel economy or a clean energy economy. It's do we have a livable planet in a planet that's more fecund and more full of life than it was yesterday, or do we have a planet that's being gutted and torn down in the name of the cheap consumer good? So.
Yeah.
And people construct their identities around these technologies. It's a little creepy. I mean, wind turbines and solar panels kind of constitute an identity for some people. So when you criticize, you know, these machines, basically, I think people feel like you're criticizing them as people. And that, I think that plays into a large degree into the very knee-jerk, very combative attitude people take when you criticize this stuff. So.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what Travis was saying. I think Travis was saying about people having to acknowledge that they live in a violent culture. And if you have to acknowledge that these technologies might not be good because of the whole picture, you know, not just how little they pollute, but the, you know, the whole journey there and the, especially I think the first air quotes, first world, take on it versus the people who are having the extraction done to their land base and doing the extraction for their survival, that's something people are uncomfortable broaching, is this idea that we want to stay comfortable here. And then these ideas about what's going to happen to the rest of the world stay kind of vague, you know. Yeah, that's where it gets uncomfortable for people. Well, if half the world already doesn't have electricity, they'll be fine. And we'll just keep having electricity here, is kind of the subtext there, which is not somewhere most people want to go.
Absolutely. Green technology allows people to kind of simultaneously hold on to the industrial fantasy of this world, you know, that oil created, and then, you know, and all the comfort and elegancy that go along with that. But they also get to hold on to their personal purity and live this, like, green, kind of supposedly green lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. And which, the purpose of which is, I guess, to continue to buy things and build things. I mean, I don't know. It's the other part that's interesting to me, is the psychology where people are beginning to acknowledge and kind of hem and haw that, wow, this technology isn't making us more connected to each other. Everyone having a cell phone isn't creating more deep conversations. Facebook existing isn't creating more deep conversations. So that analysis is starting to happen, I think, in the fringes of some of these same groups. So in theory, maybe we'll be able to leverage that and say, you know, maybe without all this, we'll connect to each other better again.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually what this whole talk is really about, is this idea of a technic. And I first learned about this by reading the essay Authoritarian and Democratic Technics by Lewis Mumford. And it's basically the idea behind a technic is that the values of a society are embedded in the technologies we create, but there's also a feedback from the technology so that we start living our lives on the terms of that technology. And I think, as you said, you know, cell phones and, you know, these machines that have come to dominate our life, I think people are realizing that they've been living on the terms of the machine instead of on the terms of, you know, other people or the natural world or just, you know, life, I guess.
Yeah. So can you give the details of the talk?
SoCan is October 4th. I think the doors are at 3:30 and start at 4.
Online here it says 3 to 5:30. Yeah, presentation at 3 is what it says on the flyer. So, great.
And that's at the main library in SoCan.
Great. And then you're continuing, right, as a tour of Vancouver,
yeah.
Washington, Albany, Oregon, and Hood River?
Yeah. Through the month of October, we'll carry this event to different locations.
Awesome. Okay, this whole angle of coming at I guess, social change in general, because at the end of the day, it's a social change that we're going to have to make. It's a set of personal and social changes. This angle of coming at it from a more radical, all-encompassing perspective seems to... I know I've received a lot of interesting reactions, and it's hard to know how to promote this idea of, well, we need to change everything and undo most of the things we do in order to live in a better way. How does that compare to more liberal solutions? Do you think there is room for some of these more like gradual change ideas, policy changes? Can all of that coexist together in your mind? Like, are we all working together even if we don't think we are, or not? It's a really bad way of asking that question. Sorry.
Well, you know, I'd start by saying that taking an honest look at the scale and the time frame that we have is one of the critical focal points that we need to focus on. We're losing 200 species per day, and we've already lost 95% of native forests. 80% of forest cover has been lost in the entire world. And so if we're looking at the indicators of ecological collapse, and if we're taking into account the time frame that even the most conservative scientists are giving, we don't have time to be, making a lot of these liberal policy-making decisions, education. We're just out of time, basically. And we need to find a different way, something more effective. And whatever that is, we need to do it. And I think can radical and liberal activists kind of live in the same world? Yes. I'm a huge proponent of reaching out to people who maybe share not 100% of our beliefs, but enough that we can work together. I think it's absolutely vital that we build coalitions across kind of ideological lines. And I think radicals make the mistake sometimes of nothing being radical enough. Mm-hmm. And so we miss a lot of opportunities for radicalizing more mainstream folks. But one of the criticisms I think I have of liberalism is that it's almost always operated under a principle of mitigation. So, let's just reduce harm within this system that accepting the system as eternal and sort of unbeatable, but how can we make the best of things within the system? So, and I think mitigation is wonderful. There's lots of liberal mainstream organizations doing great work. I mean, around here, Riverkeeper, they're kind of overseeing and watchdogging the cleanup of the Hanford site, which mm-hmm. I think is great work. But mitigation is just mitigation, and it can't be anything more, really. So there comes a point where you have to say, do we just want to reduce the rate at which harm is being done, or do we want to stop it? And so I think as radicals, there's a lot of opportunities for us to make other activists answer that question honestly. But we have to be there. We have to be at the meetings. We have to be interacting with other activists who share a lot of our same values, but maybe not 100% of them. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think historically, if you look at different movements, whether environmental or not, there's been a lot of putting off of more the radical agenda as far as, you know, abolishing the systems that create these problems in the first place, replacing the systems that cause ecological destruction, social inequality, etc. And I know many dozens of activists who mean well, but who I've grown really frustrated with because, you know, they'll say, yeah, that's my goal too, but I want to do it very gradually over 60 more years. And as you pointed out, the timeline just doesn't support that anymore. And I think it's kind of beyond time that we point out that historical fact that, like, hey, have you guys noticed that we never seem to get around to the goals that we all claim to share? I don't know.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. It's like, okay, we'll try your tactics, but only after you sign my petition, we try all of these tactics first. It's like, that's never how it works out in history. The movements that are successful are usually successful because they use all the tools in their toolbox. So whether that's nonviolent kind of mass demonstrations or boycotts or underground militants. I think if you really dig into the history, you'll see that movements like the Indian independence movement, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, the movement in Ireland to resist English oppression, the movement in the occupied countries in Europe in World War II to resist the Nazis. I think you see a diversity of tactics. That's the marker of a successful movement, in my opinion. And that's really all we're calling for. I think oftentimes EGR gets pigeonholed as the kind of bomb-throwing militant environmentalist. But in the reality is we're just advocating for using the tactics that make sense and not letting our own personal purity and ideology dictate what tactics we use. We have to let the situation dictate the tactics.
Yeah, that's something I really, I mean, having read the book, it definitely changed my thinking a lot in terms of being strategic. You know, there's a lot of tradition, I think, in social justice movements. There's a lot of like, well, this is the way things have always been done, and these are the people we've chosen to remember. So we emulate those tactics regardless of what the situation actually calls for. So, you know, I really appreciate the more strategic guerrilla warfare tactics included in there, you know? I mean, if you know that you're outnumbered and if you know the situation, we have no shortage of information, just taking a really measured look at what are the options, how do they interplay with each other, and where do we go from here? So, what do you think about that? I mean, where should we go from here? If it isn't wind and solar, how can we reduce harm to humans and the planet while stopping all of this?
Sure. I think we have to, we want to set a goal, that goal that you just talked about of stopping the destruction, stopping the harm. We have to diagnose the problem first. And from the DGR perspective, that problem is civilization. And by civilization, we mean this social and political and economic structure of people living in cities, where you have people living in concentrations higher than what the land can support. And so by definition, they have to import resources. And when trade is never, you know, trade is never sufficient enough because the systems are based on infinite growth. Capitalism is based on, it can't stagnate. If it stagnates, it collapses. So you need more and more. And the population, the patriarchal structures of that society guarantee that you'll have an ever-increasing population. Of course, this is necessary to draw, this is a necessary kind of pool of people from which to draw workers and soldiers. You know, obviously, desperate or comfortable people don't willingly go into a sugarcane field. They don't willingly go into a coal mine. They don't willingly give up their trees, their water, their air. So eventually it comes to the point where the civilized have to take it. And I think that's the path we've been on for the last 10,000 years. So what we aim to do is to sort of attack civilization at its root. And that sounds like a big job, but at this point in history, this culture is so dependent on very fragile sets of infrastructure from energy to global finance to fossil fuels. There are very obvious critical nodes where strategic action, whether nonviolent or militant, could bring the system down. And at the same time, we have to build up the kind of cultures that we've been talking about, where cultures that value human rights, participatory democracy, human scale community and relationship and relationship to the natural world. And, you know, that's gonna be wholly dependent on what the land base requires. So a culture here in the Hood River Valley, it's gonna be different than a culture in the Chute River sort of watershed. And that's actually how it was, for settlements. So.
Yeah, for a very long time. I mean, even just, it's interesting when we talk about individuals fitting into civilization. A lot of people will characterize human nature as being this kind of civilized, you know, domesticated human nature that people understand, that they've been involved in. You know, well, it's human nature to fight each other and be greedy and accumulate things and try to steal each other's things from each other. But if you point out to people, you know, it's only 10,000 years old. And in the course of planetary history, that's nothing. That's, you know, a breath in and out. And, so is that effective when you explain that to people and kind of, talk about the short history of civilization really in comparison to the planet and evolution as a whole? Or do you get there very often in talking with people who aren't already committed to sort of anti-civ ideas?
Yeah, that's another difficult thing for many people to swallow. I think it was Kenneth Glendinning wrote that if you could visualize like a basketball court, and then if you went from end to end, and less than, I think it was like less than an inch of that would be considered civilized, or, you know, what we know as living under industrial civilization. That means you're pretty good visualization of how short, you know, a time period that we've been living as we currently are. You know, and there's still many, you know, great cultures within all of our communities who we can learn from. And, you know, there's indigenous peoples on every continent and every community just about that still possess the knowledge, and the skills to store, you know, a lot of the balance that we need. But I think looking to them for leadership is one of the key areas that we can focus on.
Yeah, and those have been the people also at the front lines of, as far as stopping a lot of this, extraction from taking place and expansion of it. I mean, from Idle No More to other just, not movement affiliated, indigenous people have been working to stop and have at least, slowed and in some cases halted that development. You know?
Exactly. So. Exactly. Yeah, we had a couple members join the Unistoten camp in northern British Columbia, who are blocking some of the pipelines that are headed towards the coast from northern BC. And yeah, it's high time that most of the privileged classes within the environmental movement are taking those front lines and stepping up. Absolutely.
Yeah, there was...
I mean, it's really easy.
Oh, go ahead.
It's really easy, I think, for sort of privileged, comfortable, usually white, middle class activists to say that we, violence never works, we can't use violence, that's not what we're about. I think it's easy to say that when violence is not an everyday part of your existence and it's not being constantly wielded against you. And if we don't use every tactic that's available to us, it's going to fall to people who are already facing just a barrage of horrible circumstances, state repression, incarceration, sexual violence, economic violence, poverty. It's gonna fall to them to do this work, and I don't think they should have to do that alone.
Yeah, and I saw that there was some lip service paid to this, to the frontline and indigenous communities at this recent, at the big People's Climate March in New York City, which is being touted as being 400,000 people. There's been some really good critique of that and documentation about that coming out. On the one hand, you know, for me, like, it is good to see hundreds of thousands of people mobilizing about the only issue that really matters for us now, which is climate change. But it was also really depressing for me because you see all these people making this huge appeal to authority, you know, giving more authority to the UN, to the government, to make policy changes, to give us these nice green jobs and everything. And there was some lip service paid there to these frontline and indigenous communities. But I don't know. What's your take on that whole event and the following day, the Flood Wall Street action and everything?
Well, I'll start by saying I read a really great piece by Quincy Saul in Truth Out. And he begins his article by quoting from Malcolm X's autobiography, where he draws the similarities between the March on Washington and the Climate People's March. He starts by saying, or Malcolm X says, "March in Washington, I call it. It was like a movie for the status seeker. It was a status symbol. Were you there? It had become an outing again. What originally was planned to be an angry riptide, one English newspaper aptly described now like a gentle flood. There wasn't a single logistics aspect uncontrolled. They had been told how to arrive, when, where to arrive, where to assemble, when to start marching, the route to march. Yes, I was there. I observed that journey." I think that's just an incredible, piece to draw from. And, just reading about, a lot of the, what happened last Sunday, you see huge numbers, which is neat to see. And you see how they were corralled through their marching, course. And then we saw, later on at the conference itself, those in power, just making empty promises. So, I don't know what came of it. Guys just bring a large group of people and maybe dissipating some of the energy that could have been used for more strategic, longer term activism.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I totally agree with that. And I don't want to say, I think there are people who went into those marches. I mean, I went. I think there are people involved in the marches that are wonderful activists and doing lots of great work. And I don't want to disparage kind of the individual people who attended the march, but as an action, I mean, here is a week later, supposedly the march is going to be a game changer. I don't think anything has really changed. We're still going for it and pumping carbon in the atmosphere. So, I mean, and just that word, game changer. I mean, our language that we have available to us to talk about revolutionary ideas, our revolutionary language has been taken away from us. Mm-hmm. And so all we have left are these marketing buzzwords like game changer and you know, whatever other green job creation, just this capitalistic language that we're forced to use. I mean, even the word sustainability, I love that word, but it's sustainable is just, it's an empty, it's been stripped of all meaning. I mean, we're calling economic development sustainable now.
Yeah.
Sustainable development.
Yeah. Walmart has signs about their deep commitment to sustainability. So if the, you know, the biggest corporation in the country can do it, so can you, you know? I've been hearing held up as a success is some divestment from fossil fuel holdings by some of these large companies. Do you want to talk about that at all? And how does that fit into, in theory, they're not just taking that money and making it disappear. They're going to reinvest it into something else, most likely solar and wind. So kind of to go full circle, what do you think about fossil fuel divestment as a strategy that's being promoted and with some wins?
I mean, it's just, first of all, at least in the United States, fossil fuels aren't a great investment right now anyway, because there's a huge glut of just coal and natural gas on the market right now, and the prices are so low, so it's not really, I mean, they're investing in something that's a poor investment anyway. Like, I don't think it's really taking, there's no skin off them to divest from fossil fuels right now. But when the price goes up, I think we're going to see these banks. I mean, these are institutions that invest in everything from laser-guided bonds to landmines. I mean, they're not driven by ethics. They're driven by profit. And so you can't expect, you can't expect those in power to act against their own interests out of ethics. I mean, it's symbolic. Capitalism is very good at sort of taking energy that's directed against it and consuming it, and allowing people to feel like their values and sort of political ideas are being, that they're playing out in a larger culture when in reality they're not. I mean, this is standard kind of oppression 101, where if you make people feel like they have a choice, even if those choices are within an extremely narrow range of possibilities, it's easier to get people to go along. So that kind of symbolic divestment that we saw immediately after the climate march, I think falls into that category.
And those corporations that are investing in renewable energy are making tremendous profits. Renewable energy subsidies take, you know, taxpayer money and give it directly to the corporation. So, you know, companies like GE and BP and Samsung and Mitsubishi will take the profits that they're making and invest it in, you know, their other business activities. So, you know, something has seriously gone wrong when the environment starts accepting the word of a corporation.
Yeah, something else that we haven't mentioned but that goes hand in hand with all of this is the promotion by liberals and also by the people on the right, what people in this country consider the right, but is really like the extreme right, are finally the ones who are slowly acknowledging maybe this climate change thing is real. The most that a lot of these people are advocating is cap and trade, is carbon trading, carbon markets. You know, and that just kind of comes back to, I think, Einstein and other people saying you can't solve problems with the same thinking that created the problems, you know. It's like, if people claim to not trust these people on Wall Street, investment, they don't trust the personal greed of people, even if they don't admit they don't trust the system of capitalism and accumulated wealth, you know, it seems illogical to hand over this big problem to those same people to try to solve. I don't know.
Exactly. Sorry about my dog. He's trying to join in on the discussion here.
Oh, no worries.
Right. I mean, like the cap and trade scheme. There are companies that are making, that are involved in some really nasty stuff, that are making a ton of money on this, carbon, on the market of these carbon credits. So, you know, again, it's like, I don't think there's any system of regulations that can make this way of life sustainable. It just functionally isn't sustainable. It requires, we have, live on a finite planet, and it requires infinite growth. I mean, this isn't difficult, this isn't cognitively challenging, but I think we're so blinded by our own kind of cultural indoctrination and our own insecurities here in the first world that we, even environmentalists can't do that.
Do you mean personal insecurities, like on an individual level related to that culture?
Right, yeah, just fear of losing the kind of comfort that we've, and technological, again, let's call it advancement that we've come to enjoy. I mean,
or feel entitled.
Yeah, or feel entitled, yeah. Or kind of associate with human progress and this idea of evolution toward this ideal human state.
Yeah. So I'm primarily interested, if we're going to look at the, you know, taxonomy of action and tactic that's in the book, Deep Green Resistance, I'm a building alternatives person because it's more hopeful to me. You know, you get to work with people, you get to be creative, build these new systems. How do you see that angle of this moving forward? You know, when we stop all of this extraction and pillage of the planet, how are we going to support each other in that readjustment, and how do you see that moving forward?
Sure. The primary emergency is stopping the destruction. So the culture doesn't, you know, if we wait until it's culture collapses on its own, which it is going to, all civilized cultures collapse. It's, whether it's, you're talking about the Egyptians, the Greeks, the ancient Akkadians, the Romans, they hit a wall of resource extraction, they've denuded as much as they can, or they've taken as much as they can take from the land and they collapse. So that's where we're headed. But if we wait until this culture collapses on its own, it's going to be too late. There isn't going to be anything left to live on. And I think in that scenario, you know, this generation that's being born is just going to live in, they're going to be, they're going to be in a really tough situation in terms of having, being able to exist. So the first step, so we have, that has to be our primary, I think, objective, but if you feel that your skills and interests and just passion for building these alternative communities, there's so much you can do. I probably couldn't even kind of describe the number of like the different areas where someone could do good work in that kind of segment of resistance. But I think a big thing for me that I feel passionate about is building our alternative food networks, especially for resistors. So learning things like permaculture and or agroforestry, or, you know, all these different great ways of living sustainably and providing specifically providing food sustainably. That's an area where I think a lot of good work can be done. I think building alternative education systems is going to be a huge component of a culture of resistance. We need a way of countering the kind of cultural and the cultural indoctrination and the value system that our current education system provides. So, you know, we're basically teaching children how to be good little workers, good little cogs in the machine, when really for this generation, learning how to grow your own food, learning how to build a functioning, equitable community, learning how to develop relationships with the natural world are going to be way more important for them. So I think alternative education, things like resistance schools, are really important to me in terms of building a culture of resistance. I think that's a huge kind of hole in our culture of resistance right now. So. And making the culture of resistance intergenerational too.
Yeah, definitely. I see a big gap. I know a lot of people, not a lot. I wish I could say I knew a lot of people around my age, you know, in their late teens, early 20s, who are deeply dissatisfied. They know that something's quite wrong with what's going on, but, you know, they don't know what's going on. Most of the cool radical folk I know are between 50 and 70. So I think your point about education is really key. And just getting people to have the confidence, too, to even assert their ideas and communicate them, let alone act on them, is something we got to get to. So, what else do you want people to know about? I mean, this is kind of a vague question, but what do you want to emphasize for people who maybe are just hearing some of these ideas for the first time right now? You've crushed their dream of the solar utopia. What do you want these people to hear and know about?
Well, I think the first thing that I would want people to take away from this talk is that it's not hopeless. You know, kind of pulling our hair and gnashing our teeth and saying, oh God, it's all over. That's not helpful. That's not... And that's kind of a cop-out. So one phrase that Lee R. Keith, one of the authors of the Peace and Resistance book, was that we need to take our hearts out of cold storage. I know we put them there for safekeeping. So we need to be reality-based adults, and I think we need to face this situation that we're in and do what needs to be done. Travis?
I'd agree with that. Just, it's time to take responsibility. I guess one of the things I left out of my introduction that really drew me to DGR was starting a family and having children and realizing that, you know, 50 years from now, my daughter's not going to care whether, you know, I went to a protest or whether I did this or that, whether she has, you know, clean water to drink and clean air to breathe. And so, you know, it's time to take responsibility and find what what your niche is, find what you can do to transform the situation that we're in. Look into DGR. I think we have a pretty sound, solid strategy. Certainly could use more both.
Great. So this presentation in Spokane, for our Spokane people, October 4th, Saturday, presentation begins at 3 p.m. Doors are at 2:30 at the downtown public library, presumably in one of the downstairs meeting rooms, but I'm sure there will be signage and someone there to tell you. And it's open to the public, and it should be really interesting to hear. I'm going to intentionally invite some folks who I know have resistance to some of these ideas and also the people who are already on board, because I think we have a culture of passive aggression that it's part of my personal mission to destroy in myself and others. I think direct communication, man, that's a big part of this.
Right. That's another thing I want to emphasize, that we're not just getting up there and bashing green energy. I mean, this is a very measured, I think very compelling argument that we're presenting. And even if you at the moment really believe in green energy, I just think this is good information. This is good information just about how the world of industrial manufacturing works, how a political movement is constructed. So.
Awesome.
Well, and we left time for Q&A too if you want to really get up and challenge us. So.
Yeah, start writing your questions now. No. Great. Well, is there any last words you guys want to offer before we wrap up here? Our hour has kind of flown by.
One thing I do want to plug shamelessly is a big conference in San Francisco that's happening this November. I've been doing some organizing and kind of promotional work for it. I think it's going to be really great. It's called Earth at Risk. You can find information about that at earthatrisk.info. It's just going to be awesome. We've got it's 2 days. The first day is focused on social justice, so there's going to be panels with all kinds of great activists, big names like Alice Walker, Vandana Shiva. And then the next day is going to be focused on the environment. You have people like Derek Jensen, Dar Jamail, Guy McPherson. I think Chris Hedges is going to be there. I mean, just pretty much every awesome person you've ever heard of is going to be there. So if you can get to San Francisco in November, do it.
What are the dates?
November 22nd and 23rd.
Well, great. So, thank you both for joining me. And I'm really glad we got to talk. And this is going to be, if you're listening to this, you are listening to it on the podcast, so I don't need to tell you that. I will also hopefully be able to rebroadcast it on the air on the live show, which is the day of, which is my first Saturday show. So, good stuff coming up. Travis and Carson from Deep Green Resistance.
Deep Green Resistance, Lower Columbia.
Lower Columbia. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.